Okay, I'd like to welcome everybody to our January 20th, 2022 regular meeting of the Marysville Board of Education. Can I have a roll call, please?
Mr. Ferguson?
Here.
Mr. Keck?
Here.
Ms. Savage?
Here.
Mr. Smith?
Here.
Ms. Devine?
Here. Thank you, and if you'd all join and stand and join me at the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. So I would accept a motion to adopt the agenda for tonight's meeting.
So moved.
Motion by Ms. Savage.
Second.
Second by Mr. Smith. A roll call.
Ms. Savage?
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Mr. Ferguson?
Yes.
Mr. Keck?
Yes.
Ms. Devine?
Yes. Motion carries. And next we have the Employee of the Month to recognize. So I would accept a motion to approve Jamie Unger as the Classified Employee of the Month for December 2021.
So moved.
Motion by Ms. Savage.
Second.
Second by Mr. Keck. Mrs. Allen, would you like to share some information with us and have Jamie come on up, right?
That's right. Come on down.
Is it on the map?
Come on up.
There you go. Not connecting.
First of all, congratulations. It's my pleasure to be able to read what your peers have written in order to recommend you for this award. So those of you who don't know, Jamie serves as a nurse at Creekview Intermediate School, and it's my pleasure to really share these comments. I'm not sure I could find any reason that Jamie doesn't deserve this recognition. She is always helping everyone and is the definition of a team player. She is knowledgeable, hardworking, always present, great with her kids, great with the staff, and gives more than she receives. Not only can she run the clinic with absolute precision, but she can step in and run the office if need be. If we are short-handed, she will jump in and take care of us by answering phones, answering the door, helping with kids in the office, late sign-ins, and she will even do dismissal and call buses. Jamie keeps us updated and informed of all the new protocols and updates regarding COVID. And we work as a team to keep things running. I don't think I would want to work with anyone else. Whether she realizes it or not, she is the glue that holds us all together. So congratulations, Jamie. We appreciate everything. It's been quite a couple months even lately, so just thank you for everything.
I'll make you run like a little obstacle course here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
While you're getting the picture there, I was telling Jamie when we walked in the auditorium that I had found a note, a letter that she had sent out to parents, I think late in or mid-December, with some updates on COVID, and it was so well written, so clear, and And I thought, wow, it's just, it's impressive to see things like that because as board members, you know, we don't always see all the information that's coming out and the work and thought that goes into a lot of things that our employees do. So congratulations again. And with that, I would accept a roll call to make this official.
Ms. Savage?
Yes.
Mr. Keck?
Yes.
Mr. Ferguson?
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Ms. Klein?
Yes. Motion carries. And one more round of applause. Now, I don't believe we have any public participation. Okay. Then we will... Thanks again. We'll move right into the reports. And the first report tonight, it's usually our Ohio High Point report. And for tonight, I just would have the pleasure of introducing Mr. Steve Cox, who is going to be sworn in at High Point on January 26th as the Marysville Board of Education High Point rep. Steve, if you would like to come on up here, we'd be happy to shake your hand and you know, just let you know how much we appreciate your commitment to helping us partner with High Point and sharing some of your expertise, listening, learning, and just helping us out. So we really appreciate that. Thanks again. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I know. Yeah, and for those of you who may not know Steve, he and his wife are co-owners of three different franchises in this area, and he has served on their advisory board with a stint as the board chair before, and so I think he's going to be a great representative for us and very knowledgeable in the business world and job development, things like that. So again, thank you very much. Next report would be our superintendent report.
Okay, so Ashley and I are going to tag team for you the COVID update. I will not pretend to be Mark Gallagher and have his level of expertise about the data, but we will talk through about really our current experience since winter break is our focus tonight. As well as we did hold a superintendent's task force meeting on Tuesday of this week, and then talk about our steps moving forward. James, you could go to slide 3, would be great. Actually, just move on to 4 would be even better. So as you know, we've approached the school year really with a 5-day all-in focus. And certainly it's been challenging with the increase in our community really since winter break in particular. We've had different spikes and plateaus, but this has been a challenge. As you've seen, I've sent several critical staffing level letters out to families. We have 3 buildings currently in Mass, Northwood, Edgewood, and Mill Valley. And honestly, we're going to get a little bit into the data, but really our impact doesn't appear to be significantly school spread, but just the fact of household contacts and kind of that community piece. So as we look at our current data, so if you take from January 5th to yesterday, this chart represents the amount of staff cases and student cases. Out of school quarantines, you may say, well, how can we still have that? That would be more like a household contact that needs to stay home. Now with masks to stay, our student, do you remember earlier in the year where we were really sending people home that were very healthy? Mm-hmm. So we went to masking. Shortly after we removed that mask recommendation, the mask to stay option became available to us. So you can see really over 1,000 students have been able to stay in school since those guidelines have changed. So that's been a game changer for us. Now, as the
Speed up. Okay.
So the last column shows, really on the back end, Kim and Mark do, honestly, a lot of hand calculation every night and track our close contacts, so people who would have been quarantined or are now masked to stay, how many of those actually transition into a case. So you can see that 47 of those have transitioned since we returned on January 5th.
Quick question, is that 47, is that staff and students?
Yes.
Okay.
Combination.
Thank you.
Now, I will tell you, in all honesty, one case that I know has switched, the parent said, well, we've been notified by the dance studio, the school, and Boy Scouts. So it could have been any of those platforms. So just a reminder that, you know, we are really learning how to live with COVID, which I think is a pretty thing, important thing to remember. It's here to stay, and so it definitely has a presence right now that we are hoping, we're on the down. My gut is we'll have another little peak in about mid-February. We'll start to see some relief. My gut is just based on that, not data necessarily.
Okay.
So just remember that. This slide represents our experience as a community by zip code. Park shares this every month to just kind of give you a reminder of the case rate per 100,000. So obviously there's high spread throughout both zip code areas that impact our school district. The next slide is an indicator of our transmission rates. So you can kind of see where we are. Remember, this is our 7-day case rate per 100,000. So you can see that we are, again, headed in the down direction after that peak. Mark also likes to talk quite a bit about the wastewater gene copies that are found in wastewater. And if you look at this, you can see that it still remains pretty all over the place, but it does seem to be trending down again. And we've done a little research. There is a body of research out there that does suggest that the gene copies is a pretty good way to kind of look at or forecast what might be happening, really with that as a leading indicator of like in the range of 2 to 8 days. So we've been watching that kind of throughout our experience, and we kind of run hand in hand within a week, honestly, of that as well. The next slide is actually just our current case and quarantine experience for students and staff right now. So kind of gives you an idea of what we're facing. We met on Tuesday with our advisory group, and I think I've mentioned to you before that we definitely have I think Ms. Savage has been to a couple groups. We definitely have a wide range of perspectives in that group that represent our community pretty well. So there was a lot of conversation about next steps and how do we continue to push through for our kids and make sure they are receiving the best. And we also had some follow-up conversation about how did you feel about the remote learning plan? Did you get enough information? Do you understand the difference between short and long term? What else could we do to better inform you as families? I think Ashley will take over.
Yeah. So the four points that we tried to hone in on are on the next slide here. Like Diane said, we focused on our communication around being able to anticipate what a short term and a long term remote learning plan might look like. Just to kind of reiterate, a short term would be used if we couldn't operate a building due to maybe staff absences or a department absence or even transportation. And then we're also mimicking that short-term remote learning experience on calamity days 4, 5, and 6 that could be weather-related. We feel an urgency and a need to stay connected as much as possible because we've had such a fractured couple of years as far as learning it goes. So that's kind of our commitment back to our kids. We talked about transportation challenges. Really, we're having frequent updates that transportation's running on the cusp of not having really, I keep saying, deep bench as far as being able to fill absences there, and that's important for us to get our kids to and from school safely. We did talk about, you know, how is the dashboard resonating with you now? We've been through so many iterations of what we're communicating. The protocols have changed from the county and the state, so we wanted to make sure that we had their perspective as to what's priority for them on the dashboard. And then we're really honest about just how can we strike a balance between what their priorities are, what our workloads are in the buildings, and strike a balance between what's it take to operate a building, continue insulating teachers from that burden of COVID, and make sure they can focus on teaching and learning, and also communicate, operate safely, and really be nimble in those times that we need to make short-term shifts. So we had really good conversation. What we did was we were on Zoom from a safety standpoint, and we broke out into small breakout rooms because we feel everyone's voice is a little more heard when there's groups that are smaller. So they just have the same 4 points, and if we go to the next slide, I'll talk to you about some of the evidence that they, or some of the feedback that they gave us. So there was an interest for lighter communication. I think everybody's felt a communication overload these days. Like, what does apply to me as a family and as a parent of this particular student? What doesn't? They like the idea as we prepare for short-term, any need for a short-term remote learning plan, that we communicate on the day of event, which means the day we go remote. They wanted principals to communicate again, okay, what schedule are we on? Because it's just hard to kind of keep in track as you're shifting your family daily schedule. They did share that some folks are kind of getting fatigued and aren't really paying attention to some email, and I think that's a real truth for a lot of families. They wanted clarification for a day of event to know when their student could connect with their teacher via Zoom. So it wouldn't be the intensity of a full day of school, but we do have the commitment to Zoom with kids for those who can connect and those who want support. There were concerns about what does it mean to be in short term, how many days might that look like, which we didn't define, but we did try to reemphasize that it would just be on the days that we absolutely can't operate. There were concerns about students having limited access, or if they have to go to daycare, the daycare having limited access. So we talked about how we would work through those scenarios and really commit to no new learning, but really just repeated opportunities to master what's being taught. They were really supportive of our intentionality to stay connected with students and do what it takes to be in person. There was a real, I think, majority voice to stay in person and not go fully remote. So whatever it took was kind of how they were vocalizing their concerns. If you go to the next page, we talked about transportation challenges. So we really just posed the question, you know, what if transportation goes down longer than a day? What would we do? What could we do as a community? And we really just wanted their ideas so we can kind of problem solve within the district. They were, like us, had an appetite to define and run priority routes, especially towards younger children or children with need. They were open to a survey about casting which families could handle their own transportation or neighborhood transportation. They even got creative to say, could we have a community Uber system where we partner with PTOs and some other creative ideas, which we appreciated. There was a mention of some districts partnering with organizations like the National Guard to be backup drivers. So that's something, I don't know much about that, but that's something worth exploring, an interesting idea that I hadn't thought of. They felt that if transportation goes down for more than a week, they had a real desire for Chromebook pickup so that we could function more wholly in a short-term remote learning plan. So that's feedback that we took pretty seriously and would work with IT to see how we would do that on a wider scale. Like I said, we asked about, you know, what are your priorities as far as the dashboard is concerned? What are you paying attention to? And they just shared that the building level information is really important to them. And really from day one, if you've been there or listened to the feedback, they have a high hurry around having a building experience reported. They want to know how Naven is doing, or Raymond is doing, or Bunsell is doing, which makes a lot of sense from a teacher and a parent perspective. They want to know when we're entering an at-risk season, when we might mask or when we might have to go to a closure phase. They wanted to know more about case rates than contacts. So who is actually positive in the, not who, but how many are actually positive in the building. They did like seeing trends or having a report on how the trends are looking within the school district and broader community. There were mixed reviews on the usefulness of the dashboard. Again, they shared the fatigue that people aren't looking as closely, and they felt overwhelmed by the amount of communication at times, especially when it was a low-risk letter, a close contact letter, a case rate letter, a quarantine letter, all of those different forms of communication. They felt very overwhelmed by. And on the last slide, we spent some time talking about striking that balance. And so they really moved into a solution mindset here, where they were giving us suggestions about what we could do and what we could maybe decrease as far as communication or partnership and focus on schools. So one thing they said was low-risk letters seem a little irrelevant because exposures are happening everywhere. So they're more concerned with when their child has an actual close contact. They wondered if one idea from one group was, would it help reduce the communication need if we just mask district-wide for 2 weeks and get through this critical trend up with COVID? There was a frustration, which is hard for anyone to control because everyone is you know, hustling to get communication out, but there was a frustration with when they had experience at school and then heard from the Union County Health Department about whether or not they needed quarantine. Parents are in support, again, of us doing whatever we can to avoid going fully remote for a long term. They're appreciative of the building-based decision structure versus taking a district-wide approach. And there are concerns about the current surge in safety with the new variant experience here in Union County. I did try to capture just some ancillary discussion or conversation that happened during the task force, and this kind of provides a summary for you about what their appetite is for how we move forward, like Diane said, and learn to function with COVID because it's not going away, and just how we can be safe and student-centered and really return to the most robust teaching and learning model that we can. Move to the next slide. Diane, do you want to talk about this, or would you like me to? Okay.
What we really tried to do was maybe some of the feedback we received in the task force is very similar from some things you've heard, some things we heard.
I'm sorry, are you on there?
Sorry.
From parents over the past several weeks since we've returned. So what we decided to do was really look for a way to maybe simplify the scorecard, and we're going to show that to you as well. Focus on that idea of a case count. We also have heard that's probably aligned to the way the state is moving. The state is going to maybe even move away from quarantines and go to case counts only, or hospitalizations only. They're going to move away from just the case count. So we're trying to reformat and simplify that. Currently we are looking at each building when they get to that critical staffing level, notifying parents, putting them into masks. It's very difficult to say for sure at Mill Valley if you lose 5 staff members, you're automatically in critical staffing level, because it really matters on what the 5 staff, who the 5 staff members are. Mm-hmm. So we've tried to communicate quickly, and some evenings, Monday evening, we were Zooming at 8 o'clock to try to strategize and shift personnel to cover at different buildings, and we're really proud of the fact that everyone on staff has been so flexible, and we'll just, you know, continue to do that until we run out and would actually just be forced to go remote. Utilize, I think that goes right into the next one. So we will utilize the short-term remote learning plan if we reach that spot. So if we were unable to cover or operate the building, then we would look to go to that short-term plan. Really, we're trying to work on a backup plan for transportation, where we could maybe reroute everything and offer K-8 transportation only if we get in a crisis mode. One of the issues is now our transportation director is driving every single day. And so it's just compounding the problem. Really, in transportation daily, we run right on the edge of, if we lose one more staff member, we'll have to shift and cancel transportation the following day. It's that close. And really, strike a balance. A lot of the communication parents are receiving, we're required to do. And so we don't have an opt-out right now under current orders. We have already this year tried to reduce the board office communication to families and have that included in building newsletters based on the feedback from parents and the advisory group. And we'll continue to look for those opportunities to kind of scale that back, because the feeling of information overload was very real. So we sat down with Mark. Actually, we let Mark take control first, and then we sat down with him and reviewed, if you switch to the next slide, to really rebuild the dashboard. And what this, if we switched, our goal would be to switch to this dashboard on Monday. So each one of the blue lines that go up and down represent the case count. So you could hover over and see that date and the count for cases. So it would only be reporting cases, not quarantines or mask stays or anything of that nature. You'd be able to use the bar across the bottom to sort by building. So you could do all district experience or drill down to your building. This is the part I don't want to mess up. The red line you've seen, I think, in every meeting we've had this year represents the 14-day rolling average. And I already hit the last one, so that was pretty good. So it gives parents that, you know, personal experience, what's happening in their building, as well as the larger scale district moving forward. But it would get away from, we would actually still collect close contacts and everything that we need to on the back end. We would just be looking to simplify the dashboard and communicate in this way with families.
Just to add, the gray background indicates masking, and then there's a notation who is masked up beside the gray background when you see those time frames. And then, if I'm not mistaken, there's a drop down on the live dashboard that you can filter by building or district. So if you are interested in that building-based perspective, which the parents are, they would just have to manipulate that through the drop down.
Did you hear from anybody that we were not communicating enough? Or was there pretty much a general feeling that they were getting as much or more than what they wanted?
We did not hear that they were not getting enough. We did hear it's too much. So, and I think in part, you're getting a low-risk letter, then your kid might have been identified as a close contact. You know, so it just kind of compounds, and then we're sending a weekly update or whatever, and it's just a lot to digest. So I think people are trying to say, okay, how does this impact my life and my day and my home right now so that we can get to the next step, which is completely logical.
And there was, you know, any discussion that was around, like, change, which is that timing piece. that they talked about, you know, the school communication and knowing what they needed to know in order to act, and then sometimes getting other letters at a later time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know the health department is overwhelmed as well. So that's been a common frustration that we have heard, that they're not getting any communication. We don't have the ability to quarantine a student. Only the health department does, so that responsibility falls with them, and they are
promoted.
Yeah.
Well, and I think about the comment that you made about that one family that just received a letter from the dance studio, from Boy Scouts. So obviously, you know, families that have kids involved in a variety of things, they are going to be getting, they may feel like they're getting letters from everywhere.
Correct.
And so even though maybe the school only sends one letter, but they still feel overloaded. But, okay. I mean, I just first, so are you done with your presentation here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
First off, just, we can't thank you enough. You, your team, our staff, I mean, I know it has been absolutely crazy out there, just juggling around coverage, making sure that everybody's taken care of, and just the attitude of our staff to be willing to jump in and do whatever it takes. We really, really appreciate that. Hope that you will share that with them as well. And I, other than that, I didn't know, I know I saw you writing some notes there. Mr. Ferguson, do you have some questions or comments that you wanted to share?
Thank you.
Sure.
I appreciate the commitment to keep our students in school 5 days a week. As a parent of a kindergartner, it's very important to me, because like, there's no way on a computer, it's just challenging. So I do appreciate that commitment. I do have two questions. When a building goes into like a mask mandate mode, are we able to easily just deploy the Chromebooks to the students at that point in time?
If they were to go remote, do you mean?
So like my thinking is, if a building goes into a mask mandate, that means we're trending in the wrong direction. Could we then deploy, just as a cautionary measure, the Chromebooks, that way in case the next day or 2 days later we have to go remote, short-term remote, they're already equipped?
We did discuss that with some teachers and principals, and the concern really K-4 was they would actually return each day with the kid if we didn't go remote. So the idea was we would have ancillary materials that they would be able to access in different ways, like logging in from home or et cetera. But there was some concern that because we use technology every day in the classroom, that they would always come back the next day with the kid if we did not go remote. Does that make sense? So the idea would be, if we had to go longer than a couple days, much like Ashley said, could we do a drive-through where they could come through and pick them up? So that's what we're trying to organize instead.
Thank you. And then I know transportation is a big concern. What is the plan in case transportation enters crisis mode? What's the plan, and how much notice will our parents receive?
Well, we've already put our parents on notice a couple times throughout the school year. The last time, I think, was just about a week and a half ago, maybe, and just said we are at that spot again. The plan would be, we would ask parents immediately to help bring their kids to school. That's the position we got into last school year. However, we don't want that to be our permanent plan. Part of the issue is probably more complex than you want, but the way we do routing in the district is middle school, high school, and then elementary, intermediate are separate, like two runs in the day. And so even shifting and saying, okay, we'll just go back out and get kids, we're going to run into ourselves on the front end and back end of those time frames. So really the ultimate plan that's being worked on right now is, by law, we're required to provide transportation K-8. So looking at that minimum standard and figuring out a way to reroute, so that might become a you know, like an emergency route day. So today we're only going to provide transportation to emergency routes. It's just time and staff to get that filled out too. We're going to bring in some people to help build that with our transportation director. But quite honestly, right now the transportation director is probably putting in close to 17-hour days, and especially on a snow day, so it is kind of a workload tension at the moment to get them.
Okay, great, thank you. Mr. Smith, sure.
Yeah, I was going to say, one thing throughout all of the discussion seems to be that the district's goal of trying to keep the kids in school 5 days a week is supported by the community. And what I'm hearing is that there is a lot of willingness to do pretty much whatever in order to try to achieve that goal on the part of parents, which is really nice. So, as Sue said, thank you to everybody. They're doing above and beyond again, year three. But it is nice that it seems like we've reached a point where everybody has the same goal and objective. And that hopefully will make things work as smoothly as possible.
Yes, sure. Ms. Savage, sure.
Just a couple things. I just want to reiterate again that we are utilizing all of our staff, including central office staff, building admins, coaches, etc., to make sure that there are students in the classrooms and we can avoid going remote. So I think that's a critical point that, you know, the community needs to understand. Also with transportation, we've got our mechanics and our transportation director actually driving routes on a daily basis. So we're doing everything we can to make sure that we're sticking to that 5 days a week. So I wanted to appreciate that. The second thing is we had some discussion about the child hospitalization rate from the health department, and the number is extremely low. So it appears that although there is very widespread, I think I saw in the news it was close to 25% in Union County, the hospitalization rate for children is extremely low. So
we've had a couple health department meetings that Jason hasn't been able to attend, but the epidemiologist is there. And the last two times we've met, there have been zero students that have been school age, some earlier than school age and some just outside.
For pointing that out, that's good to. I mean, yeah, we don't want anybody ending up in the hospital. That's for sure. So, yeah, Mr. Peck, did you have any questions or comments?
Nope.
Okay. All right. Well, if there are no other questions or comments, thank you very much for covering for Mark. You did a great job, and we'll look forward to seeing that updated dashboard now.
Yes, starting Monday.
Okay, great. Thank you. Anything else for your superintendent's report?
Yes, okay. Just a few other things. Enrollment is staying steady with the increase around 230 students. Nothing new there. We have been holding data meetings, but we have had to postpone several this week due to classroom shortages, and principals have had to teach classes. So we'll be trying to reschedule those next week. Our goal is to, in February, to do a presentation to all of you about where we are, specifically around gap closing. So looking at our subgroup students and their performance since we've returned this year, and some of we're seeing some of that gap to narrow a little bit. So that's exciting. I also wanted to just remind you, it is approaching the end of January, so that means we will be prepping for state testing in just a short amount of time. So February, we will begin the ACT for juniors. In March, we'll do some makeup testing for that, and then April, Really beginning in April, we start off with ELA across the district, and then math, science, and social studies the end of April and into the beginning of May.
And that's it for your report?
That's it.
Okay. I'm thinking that we might have to have two. We really might have to have two meetings in February. We've got a lot of information. It sounds like
recognition. Yeah, I also think we could postpone Northwood. Another data will be inclusive of part of what we're going to present.
Right.
So maybe we push them back to March.
Okay.
If we need.
All right. Maybe we could just do one big building celebration presentation kind of a meeting. Who knows? Okay. Treasury report, Mr. Johnson.
Okay. For my report, since we've had recently and will be having in the next several meetings coming up some different resolutions relating to our renovation project, I just thought I would give a kind of a big picture overview recap of the projects that we're looking at doing. And James is working on bringing that up. We've got it. Sorry, I switched it up on you with PowerPoint instead of Google, probably. So just a little bit of a history. East Elementary, we've been leasing to the Hope Center for a little over 10 years now. Within the last couple years, we've really been doing a lot of talking internally because there were some big capital expenditures that were going to be coming up, some six-figure expenditures, most notably the roof. So we had to kind of make a decision there. Would we put that type of money into something that we're renting and getting relatively small amount of rent in return? Or, what do we do with the building? And at that point, within the past couple of years, we've kind of made the decision that it seemed like the best financial decision to sell the building to avoid those expenses. More recently, towards the end of 2021, we had an enrollment study done that we've talked about. And what we found out with that enrollment study was that the enrollment growth we're seeing and the housing and apartment growth that we're seeing in Union County and Marysville is leading to enrollment growth, but at a rate that is much more gradual than we expected. Within the past year, we were really on the mode of thinking that we were going to have to build a new building, pass a bond issue. But this study told us differently and kind of got us thinking on a different path. How can we still meet these enrollment growth needs but avoid a bond issue and an additional operating levy in building a new building? So that led to the idea of... One of the things pointed out by the enrollment study is our most immediate need is at Edgewood. So Edgewood Elementary, currently every single classroom is being utilized, and they're also even doing some type of educational work on the stage. So there's really an immediate need for space at Edgewood. So that led to the idea of turning the central office into basically an extension of Edgewood that we would be able to put five classrooms in there, which then would necessitate the need for central office to relocate to East Elementary. Next slide. So kind of looking at the big picture, kind of the why behind this idea. From a financial standpoint, it really comes down to levies and bond millage. We've talked a little bit in the past. We've got an operating levy coming up most likely in 2023. And considering a big chunk of that revenue is really just going to be replacing lost tangible personal property replacement money, because of that fact, we're probably going to be on the ballot again soon after, 4 or 5 years after, so let's just say around 2027. So considering we would have two levies on in a period of 4 or 5 years, the idea of building an additional building in that same time frame, I think, would, would be a big ask for our community, because we would be throwing an additional bond levy and an additional operating levy to staff and operate the building when we're already going to be having two other levies as well. So we really wanted to try to find a way to avoid that scenario. But at the same time, we needed the space. So there was a problem. We needed to find a solution. So the idea that we came up with the classroom space at Central Office, relocating Central Office to the East Elementary, we feel like this is the best idea because it creates a long-term benefit. It's not just a temporary fix. Some of the other ideas that we've looked at, we looked at into the idea of modulars. That would create additional space for students. But what we found is that modulars are really just an expensive band-aid. We would be putting, they're much more expensive than you would think, and then they're also only temporary. Because typically it's something that you're leasing, and then at the end of the lease, you've got nothing to show for it. We looked at the idea of just adding classroom space onto Edgewood, and we found that the cost of that project is very similar to the cost of the project we're looking at. So you'd be adding classroom space, and that would solve one problem, but it doesn't solve some of the other issues that taking over East will solve. And then also we would be looking at what would we be doing with Tri-Academy without having East. And then the other question I think that I've heard a couple different times is, well, you know, what if these enrollment projections are wrong? Which is a very good question, because there is always that possibility that they're wrong. I think an unlikely scenario is that they're wrong in the slow direction, meaning that we end up growing slower than they project. I don't think that's likely, but if that were to be the case, I still think this is a good move, because then we've not really done anything that hurts the district. You know, we've still got the space that we're going to be using because we need it immediately anyway. So I don't really see any negative if we're wrong in that direction. If the projections end up being wrong in the direction that we just are really, the growth just explodes and we don't have enough space, that doesn't necessarily make this the wrong decision. It just means that we're going to have to go back to the drawing board sooner than expected. And I think there will be a lot of different options on the table at that point. If we do get to that point, I think we'll be glad we made this decision, because we'll have an additional space to do something with, even though that's probably not, East isn't going to become a, you know, an elementary like we've talked about. That is additional space that we would have flexibility to do something with. We would have the space at Edgewood, and then, you know, then we would just have to go back to the drawing board and just look at what other ideas we could come up with to accommodate that bigger growth. Whether that would be, I guess, worst case scenario, a bond issue sooner than we wanted. Looking at East, some of the main priorities that we would accomplish with this project, we would have a permanent home for Tri-Academy. And again, that's something where we looked at other options. Are there spaces existing within our current buildings where we could put Tri-Academy? And we really didn't find anything that we felt would work. That's not something where we want to go buy a building or be paying rent long term when we have an existing building that we own. I think a big benefit of this will be having a central office that can grow with the district. You know, even if it's not for 10 or 15 years, I think at some point the district is going to look a lot different than it is now with that growth. And to think the central office won't have to grow with it, I think would be short-term thinking. There's a good chance that we'll have to expand our human resources department or our special ed department or those kinds of things. So this will give a central office that should last for decades. So we're not coming back to the voters at some point, even if it's way down the road, saying, hey, we need to pass a bond issue for a central office, which is obviously often a hard sell compared to passing a bond issue for educating students. Another nice component of East Elementary will be adding a welcome center. That's something that is going to be used more and more often as more families are coming into the district. The permanent board meeting space, as you can see, it takes a lot of work to set up the meetings here. Our tech department is already kind of stretched with all the other things that they do, so this is just an added stress for them. And then also, it's just additional usable space. I think every week somebody's coming up with an idea of, oh, here, you know, this is a great idea for what we'll do with some of the unused space in East. One way to look at it is that, you know, we're basically adding 50,000 square feet of usable space for the district. And that's at a cost price tag of around $2.5 million, is based on our early estimates. So while right now, not all of that 50,000 square feet do we have a plan for how we're going to use it, you really could not replace it or go get that kind of space at anywhere near that type of price tag. So it's a good use of an existing asset. Next slide. Just to talk a little bit about the cost slash benefit. From a cost standpoint, just the dollars and cents, the good part about this project is that it fits within our PI fund, which means we're able to do it without asking for a tax increase, without asking for a new levy. And at the same time, it helps us get to our 2029 goal when the bond issues fall off the books. So from a financial standpoint, that's one of the biggest benefits. It helps us get there to where hopefully when we do need a new building, we've got some millage falling off. So when we have to ask for additional millage, that will be hopefully fully or partly offset. One question that we've got, and I'm sure people in the community might ask as well, is why don't we just turn East Elementary back into an elementary? And that's also, you know, a fair question. We had an architect come in and do an assessment of what the cost to turn East back into an elementary would be. That number came back at $14 million. Now, I would say that that doesn't mean we couldn't do it cheaper. I think that number is maybe turning back into almost like a brand new building. So I think there's ways we could probably value engineer and get that number down. Mm-hmm. But let's just say the number, we can get it down to $8 to $10 million. Mm-hmm. That's still two-thirds of the cost of a brand new building, which with the Ohio School Facilities Commission, that they would recommend against that based on their guidelines. They also recommend against a building of that age having kindergarten students in it, so that would disqualify the district from receiving any OSFC funding, which would benefit our taxpayers in the future if we are able to get OSC funding for a new building. And then the other thing with, if we did want to turn East back into an elementary, we would need a bond issue and an operating levy to do so. And considering we have an immediate need for space, there's really not a, in my opinion, financial way to make that happen anytime in the near future, because we would have to do a bond issue to get that type of money to fully renovate it, and then we would have to also do an operating levy to staff a new building. You need a new principal, additional staff, and those kinds of things. So the timing would not be right for that. And also, maybe from a smaller perspective, it would not be an ideal elementary. You're on a 3-acre site, which is well below the size of any of our other buildings. There's inadequate parking. There's really not great drop-off access for parents or buses. I'm sure back when that elementary was in use, I would assume that not as many parents dropped off and pick up their kids now, but if you drive by Edgewood Elementary around 9 o'clock or 3 o'clock, it's quite difficult to get around. Another cost, this isn't really a financial cost, but definitely a challenge, is that in the district occupying East Elementary, the Hope Center is going to be looking for a new space. So that's definitely a challenge that we want to help them in doing. And we're also still considering uses for the unused space, like I talked about. There's ideas internally that would benefit our students. There's potential for community partnerships. There's potential for rental revenues if outside entities want to maybe possibly rent some of those spaces. So I think there's a lot of exciting opportunities that may come out of that. Okay, and finally, on the last slide, is to talk a little bit about the upcoming timeline. So tonight on the agenda, there is a resolution which basically is to select our architect. It's kind of an all-in-one resolution where we are kind of ratifying some of the things that have already been done in terms of our selection committee reviewing the architects who responded to our request for qualifications. We've ranked those architects with OHM being the top-ranked architect. OHM is a firm that we worked with when we did the Berlin College High School renovation, so we've had very good experience with them. So this resolution would approve giving us the ability to negotiate a contract with OHM, and then we would be coming back to you at a future meeting, I would assume the next meeting, but it seems like I'm wrong whenever I assume the meeting we're coming back to. But so we would be coming back to you with a contract for approval. In February, we should be coming, the February meeting, coming to you with a resolution to approve a short list of construction managers at risk. So earlier in this month, we approved that resolution to advertise for construction managers at risk. Mm-hmm. So we will look at everybody who has applied for that, and we will narrow that down to a short list of our top several construction managers. And then in March, we would bring to you our recommended construction manager for approval. So then in March, that means everybody's on board. We've got our construction manager working together with our architect, creating a plan. So then at the earliest possible date, I believe, would be April, where we would potentially be coming to you with a final plan with a price tag to complete the entire project. And then once the project begins, and again, there's definitely some dominoes that have to fall in place at the right time to make all this work, we would plan to occupy East in December of 2022 as the central office. And the big important point there is getting everyone out of central office so that work could begin there to turn that into a classroom with the goal of students occupying central office, the Edgewood Extension, in August of 2023.
Okay, that was a nice timeline there. Thanks for going over the history and kind of giving us an idea of refreshing our memories and giving us a little additional information about that plan. So really appreciate all that. Any questions? Ms. Savage?
So I just want to clarify kind of the actual trigger point, which means go for the project, is April approval. After the architect and the general contractor have become very familiar with the facility, all the changes that need to be made, done some deep study and some cost analysis prior to pulling the trigger, basically.
Correct.
Okay. So any critical issues would be identified in that time period between now and April.
Correct, right. Well, I mean, I think the key is getting the construction manager on board and working with the architect, and that's when they'll really dig in on the actual plan for the building. There's already been preliminary work done. The architect has already been through the building. We've already had specialists who look at mechanicals and those kinds of things, so they've already been through the building. So, you don't anticipate huge changes, but at the same time, you never know.
Right. It is an old building.
Right.
Okay. Mr. Peck, any questions? Nope. Okay. Mr. Smith?
Yeah, as more of a comment, I guess. I know that we've looked at and tried to evaluate a lot of different options, and I really appreciate the fact that our administrators have come to us and said, we have a way that we can meet our needs without having to ask for additional tax dollars, that we can do this with the funds that are available. I like also the approach of the manager at risk, construction manager at risk, working with the architect and taking what could be considered two separate projects and kind of putting those projects together so that hopefully we end up with a more seamless process and having some experience with at least one of the architects is, I think, also a positive. The timeline looks aggressive to me, but I was sitting here thinking there's no site work. They're not going to be moving dirt substantially anyway in the process. And I know that with our athletic fields, rain was a huge issue and mud was a problem. So I have great confidence that this looks like it's going to come together well.
You bring up, you reminded me of a good point, because when we looked into the idea of adding on to Edgewood versus doing the project as we're talking, that's the architect brought up that there are all the different supply chain shortages you're seeing everywhere. They're seeing that more when it comes to building new space like that, when it comes to different like roofing aspects and insulation and things like that, that one could potentially create a big problem, whereas with what we're doing, you don't have to get into some of those items. So that should help that timeline.
Okay. Mr. Ferguson.
Thank you. I think the timeline is aggressive. What's our contingency plan? Do we need students in the classroom by August 23?
I wouldn't say that if we can't do it, that we're going to be at emergency status. But the plan is to have it. They could use it now, but they're using the space as creatively as possible. I don't know. We would have to look at, are there other ways to utilize space? To take advantage of that until the time came, and then also, I guess there would be the idea of, if it's not August, is it October? Is it, just looking at a couple months versus is it looking at a longer time period, which would then have to determine, do we need to, find a bigger, more creative idea, or is it just a simple, we're doing something for a couple months?
I think, too, we have
space available in Avon, so we could use that as a kind of we're going to use it as our overflow, but we could use that as temporary housing, if you will, and then when those spaces opened up, we could shift the kids back to that home base if we had to. That would be a reasonable contingency plan.
What's the impact on the operating budget? Will we hire new teachers to staff the additional classrooms?
From the operation standpoint, we hire new teachers when it's necessitated by the enrollment growth. So with this type of project, we shouldn't have to hire new teachers just because we're adding those classrooms. The teachers would only need to be added if it's because of the enrollment growth. So I guess that's why it's different than creating a new building, because if we're creating a new building, then those are all new classrooms that need new teachers. Even though it is new classroom space, it's creating more space in the building. We've got the largest kindergarten class that we've ever had. So, based on that, we're likely to add new staff, but it's not because of that project, it's because of that kindergarten class flowing through. So we would likely add an additional first grade teacher next year as that class flows through.
And Edgewood's an interesting building. It's obviously, I think, the oldest building. But some of them, while it has the same number of classrooms as Northwood and Mill Valley, if I'm not mistaken, the square footage is drastically smaller. And some of the classroom square footage is really small. So I think last meeting I talked about, we have fourth graders in some of the smallest square footage classrooms. So our kind of class cap is 28 in fourth grade. Well, 28 in that space is rough, to say the least. So, working with the staff and the principal to decide, we're going to move those fourth graders over to those bigger classrooms, create more space, what kind of shifting can take place.
It creates a home for those therapies that are taking place on the stage right now that don't really have a home as well.
Thank you. And my last question is, what's the communication plan with Edgewood PTA or the parents at that school to let them know, here's our plan, this is the timeline, and how are we going to involve them in the collaboration piece?
Yeah, I think once we get the construction manager involved and then we really start getting a more, I guess, concrete plan together, we will want to involve parents from Edgewood. I think the simplest way to do that would potentially be maybe at a PTO meeting. The principal has already discussed this with staff, so he will be involved in determining the best way to get that out to the parents.
And he already did meet with the PTO as well. After we had our meeting, he was able to meet with his PTO leadership and start to have that discussion. So.
Okay. Great. That just made me remember, I was wanting a reminder of when the next redistricting is scheduled to take place.
I think we have 2 years.
2 more years. Okay, yeah, because that's how I was just thinking, well, depending on the timing of this, I was thinking redistricting was going to be happening sometime in that time frame.
I think 2 years is the plan, and then
yes.
3 years would be implementation.
Okay. Okay.
So, off
gotcha.
The top of my head, I'll clarify that.
Okay, great, thank you. Any other updates, Todd?
Nope, that's it.
Okay, great, thank you very much. For my report, I'd normally start with student achievement, and if you'll recall, at our organizational meeting, Mrs. Savage is going to be our student achievement liaison this year. So I did think Dr. Kim Miller-Smith, who heads that up at OSBA, she has Nan's name and contact information. I forwarded the Success magazine to Nan this month and didn't know if there was anything that you wanted to share this month or do you just want to start next month?
I think we're going to just start next month.
Okay, good. And I think I plan to add that to our report section to have a separate report for student achievement next month. So thank you. Also, we're going to be starting back with our community coffees, hopefully, in February. And we've always done that on the Saturday before our board meeting, and that would be February 12th from 9 to 10 a.m. Guessing that we may still try and do the library?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's working pretty well.
Yeah.
And unless we start getting a larger group of people, I would say that as long as we're having just the 4 or maybe 5 people, that's no problem. But if it gets much larger, I could shift to the basement.
Okay.
Which would give us a lot of room.
Okay, right. And we will, there's always an email that's email reminder sent out to parents the week of the community coffee, and we'll make sure that our website is updated with that information as well. Finally, I am scheduling a special meeting on Wednesday, February 2nd at 4:30, and that's going to be executive session for our mid-year evaluation of our superintendent and treasurer. So I know it's been a crazy year, but we do have 2 new board members. I think that's going to be a nice opportunity for us to sit down, review those goals, and have some of those conversations about what's happened so far this year and what the plans are for the remainder of the year. And which reminds me, I also wanted to make a comment with your presentation, Todd, just how much I appreciate both you and Diane have taken the time to sit down with Mr. Keck and Mr. Ferguson and try and bring them up to speed as much as possible with a lot of information that's out there right now. So I appreciate that. And that's it for my report. Mr. Smith, legislative report.
Thank you very much. There are basically 4 items on the report this month. The first topic is House Bill 126, something that we've talked about for several years, and I had a conversation with Representative Tracy Richardson about it. House Bill 126 started out several years ago and remained pretty much a bill that would require boards of education to pass a resolution if they were going to challenge a property value. That passed in the House earlier last year. it went to the Senate, and the Senate now has added several other features, prohibiting any person or political subdivision from filing a property tax complaint with respect to the property that a person or political subdivision does not own. So under that, the only person that can file a complaint in the Board of Revisions would be the property owner, and that's a pretty significant change and would potentially put our school district, as well as other school districts in the state of Ohio, in a very difficult situation. And I've conveyed that to our representative. She agreed that what the Senate did was make a very significant change to the bill. And at the end of our conversation, she was suggesting that maybe the House have some committee hearings before they take a vote of concurrence with the Senate. So we'll kind of wait and see what happens with that. I did note that our state senator, Bill Renneke, did not vote on HB 126. He was in quarantine at the time. If he had been present and voted no on that, he would have been the only Republican to vote no. The second thing involves OSBA and NSBA. I'm a member of the Federal Relations Network, and in past years, new members, I've gone in, to Washington, D.C. to lobby on behalf of our district and Ohio. Those lobbying efforts over the last several years have resulted in some additional funds for IDEA, which is Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and also we believe that it helped with broadband funding. Now, some of that came as part of CARES and HRSA and some other things, but at least we were raising the issues for the legislators at that time. A letter was sent by NSBA to the president requesting the Justice Department address threats of violence, disruptions, and things at school board meetings. Almost immediately, Ohio withdrew from NSBA. We were one of the first states' associations to do that. And so the question rests that there is a benefit to lobbying the federal government. There are some good things that can come out of that. There's also some training and just general information that NSBA was providing. And so what does OSBA do in order to try to replace that? So I provided some information for you. The executive director, Rick Lewis, even before that letter was sent, had been asked by the Board of Trustees to look for some other possibilities as opposed to NSBA, because there were some financial issues, there were responsive issues, there were some cultural kinds of issues that the trustees felt were becoming a real problem. As a result, there is a new organization that is being created, a consortium of state school board associations, and it would focus on three main areas: networking, training, and advocacy. And I had a Zoom meeting about this where Rick and the lobbying effort from OSBA were asking the members of the federal network what we thought we needed to do. And out of that discussion, one thing was very clear, was that the training is important. That those three things are important: the networking, the training, but more importantly, maybe the advocacy. And the advocacy as a concerted effort by all of the school districts in the state of Ohio. Large school districts, small school districts, everybody being represented and presenting kind of a united front on a few key issues that tend to affect education across Ohio. So OSBA is now working to try to put some of all that together. I provided a long article that you can read at your leisure that will give you some more information. The Ohio Supreme Court made a ruling 4-3 that the state legislative maps that were submitted were unconstitutional and didn't meet the needs of our state. And so in a short period of time, new maps have to be created, and that could and will likely affect who our state senator is, could impact our state representative, could impact our congressional district, and so forth. So it's something that we do need to be aware of. And finally, a group of schools has filed a lawsuit in Franklin County Court that challenges the constitutionality of the Ed Choice Voucher Program. And the basis of the lawsuit is really pretty simple, that nowhere in the Ohio Constitution is there any authority given to the legislature for vouchers. And it will be of tremendous interest to every school district in Ohio to see how that lawsuit comes out. I've provided some additional information there. There was, I want to point out, one bill that Governor DeWine signed. Senator Renicki had sponsored Senate Bill 166 that provides student pathways in career tech education. And essentially, this bill provides the opportunity for an employer that offers mentoring or internship opportunities to recover some of the costs of that mentorship or that internship. And it was a great piece of legislation. It was one that I spoke to both of our representatives, Renicki and Richardson, about, and said that that would fit in with our district and the things that we're doing in our district beautifully. And I've been trying to arrange a time for Senator Renicki to come and look at some of the things that we have going on in our school district so he becomes more familiar with what we're doing, but we haven't been able to because of COVID, school schedules, and all that kind of stuff, get that arranged. So thank you.
Thank you. Lots of good information. I really appreciate the additional articles and as always, just the time that you spend reaching out to our representatives as well. So thank you, Mr. Smith. Safety report. We have a new person covering our safety report now, Mr. Ferguson. I know we managed to hook you up there with Nancy Beals with the Drug Free Coalition, but go ahead if you'd like to report something tonight.
Yes, thank you. I do have just a short report. I did have a conversation with Nancy this week with the Union County Drug Free Coalition. There is an infograph informational sheet that we can distribute to the district. It's really about a psychoactive drug that's on the market in some of our stores in the community. It's taking hemp products and really giving them the same properties as marijuana. So Delta 8 THC, they infuse like vapes, gummies, syrup, oils, and they are legal right now. And I know the Drug-Free Coalition is looking to, for some legislative action on that. But it's important for our parents to know and to be on the lookout for these type of products because they can be very dangerous to the health and well-being of our students. So that concludes my report. Well, one thing we've discussed is I am in connection with the Union County Suicide Prevention Coalition as well, and I may add that to the report. We'll see how those conversations and that involvement goes here in the next couple of weeks. Thank you.
That sounds great. Thank you, Mr. Ferguson. Now, let's see. We are to our business section. So at this point, I would accept a motion to approve draft minutes from our December 9th regular meeting and our January 10th organizational meeting.
So moved.
Motion by Ms. Savage.
Second.
Second by Mr. Keck. Any corrections, revisions noted? If not, roll call, please.
Ms. Savage?
Yes.
Mr. Keck?
Yes.
Mr. Ferguson?
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Ms. Devine?
Yes, motion carries. Next, I would accept a motion to approve the resolution to ratify the RFQ design firm submissions and to proceed to contract.
So moved.
Motion by Mr. Smith.
Second.
Second by Mr. Keck. Any questions or comments about this one? Bring it up for anyone.
Yeah, Mr. Smith. As Todd told us, this allows the school district to move forward selecting an architect so they have a better idea and are able to formulate a plan that will meet the needs of the district. As he mentioned, it has the ultimate goal of providing some additional space for Edgewood Elementary. And I like the fact that there seem to be multiple architects that applied and were able to be reviewed. That's why I moved the passage of this resolution.
Just a quick point. So from my experience with High Point over the past 3 years, it is really important that the architecture firm and the general contractor and whoever the contractors eventually end up being have a good working relationship. It was kind of a mess to straighten out when High Point started their activities and the general contractor and the architecture firm were completely at odds. So just sharing someone else's experience. And I know you guys have been through it with the Early College High School already, but just current experience.
Any other, Mr. Head? Nothing? Mr. Bird? Nope. Okay. Then I would, how about a roll call, please?
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Mr. Keck?
Yes.
Mr. Ferguson?
Yes.
Ms. Savage?
Yes.
Ms. Devine?
Yes. Motion carries. Next, I would accept a motion to approve the treasure items.
So moved.
Motion by Ms. Savage.
Second.
Second by Mr. Smith. Mr. Johnson, any comments about your reports?
Nothing really to point out on there unless there's any questions. It's just the usual items.
Yeah. Yep, I think it was pretty straightforward. So, there are no questions. Then roll call.
Ms. Savage.
Yes.
Mr. Smith.
Yes.
Mr. Ferguson.
Yes.
Mr. Keck.
Yes.
Ms. Devine.
Yes. Motion carries. And I now would accept a motion to approve these superintendent items.
So moved.
Motion by Ms. Savage.
Second.
Second by Mr. Keck. Ms. Salen.
As you know, pretty routine things on my list, but we'll run through a series of resignations, adding eSport to our base program, so we're kind of interested to see how that evolves. I know we've had some varied interests over the past couple years, becoming more popular. The C supplementals and volunteers. We also have first read policies. I know Devine, you wanted to talk a little bit about one of those. You also have the course handbooks, course books for both high schools and early college high school. Student teachers, baseball trip, I did want to point out, I was asked a question around the baseball trip. They are staying at an Airbnb. The Airbnb is aware that there are high school students staying at their property and are fine with that.
Just looked a little bit different than maybe a trip we had would approve in the past. Are excited to have our middle school students be able to go on the DC trip this year, as we haven't, as we've had to cancel in the past. So excited for that to take place this May. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So I did want to, as Diane said, the first read of our policies on there. The one policy, BHD, was talking about board member compensation and expenses, and they made a revision to kind of bring us in line with what we've been doing. I did have a conversation with Mr. Langhouse, because the first read that's on board docs right now, the very first section said that the board votes prior to January 1st to set the rate of compensation for newly elected or reelected board members, and that's really not our practice. So, because I just spoke with him this morning, the second read is going to be revised, and that first sentence will be taken out, and the word "because" will be taken out, so then it will just read, "Compensation for board members may not be changed during their respective terms of office. Changes in compensation must be made prior to the beginning of their respective terms." And then it will have that revised line, the board member compensation will be approved at the organizational meeting each January. So that's really what we have been doing, and we know if we would approve a change at our organizational meeting, it would not take effect until you are either reelected or you are newly elected, because you're not allowed to raise your own pay while you are serving a current term. So just so you know, that second read will have that revised, that revision in there. Any other comments or questions about the superintendent action items?
I would like to just quickly mention at the policy meeting, the graduation requirement, state laws added a half year of financial literacy, and I know our administrators will work because we try to make sure that this fits in early in a student's high school career, because every time you add a requirement, you reduce in some ways the electives that students can take, and you limit some of the options and choices. So with the goal of trying to minimize that impact, our administrators are looking for ways to make sure that we meet this goal, have this instruction, but also continue to offer our students as much opportunity as possible. So a lot of good work yet to come on that.
Yeah, I have one comment. I think maybe the administrators ought to look at classes that are already teaching that, and I realize that some of those teachers might have to go out and get a certification. I know my daughter had to do that, and so that she could teach it within the ag program, and she was already teaching it. But you know, if we could not say, well, you know, we got to use up another elective spot for half a year of literacy, I agree with you 100%. And I think, you know, you look at the business classes, and you look at the FCLA, mm-hmm. I'm still on home ec, and you look at the ag classes, all those classes teach that, and I'm sure that the social studies department, history departments are teaching it also. So, you know, I was very disappointed when I saw this legislation come out, or even head that way, because it's a knee-jerk reaction to banks overselling loans to students, and it really isn't going to make that much difference, in my opinion. You know, you need that information a week before you go buy that second car and roll that loan over. So,
right.
You know.
Yeah. Good point, because I'm sure there are plenty of classes that go over a lot of that information, and then even just this last week, somebody from one of the local banks had sent some more resources that they have to help help students have a better understanding of some of those basic financial literacy topics. So I think think those would be good. And really, I think they do a great job. Looking through those course handbooks, it's just amazing the number of opportunities, the number of courses out there for our students. So I really appreciate the work and the time that goes into that.
Yeah, I was going to comment on the financial literacy requirement. I like the spirit of the legislation that was passed personally. The spirit of legislation is personal finance, and I don't think like a U.S. government course covers personal finance in the depth as students need to really enter adulthood in the marketplace with a good sense, a financial sense of how to, what impacts their personal finance. So that was a question I raised, but I understand that there is a timeline. So this requirement is for freshman class, correct?
Next year.
So not our current freshmen. Like a student in high school right now can still take a U.S. government course, and they would meet that eligibility requirement. But the next freshman class will have to take that standalone curriculum. So I do think there is a couple options, like the accounting is mm-hmm. a course that will meet that, and I think that's appropriate. I think there's very much that. So I do think the administration for adding those courses.
All right.
The only thing I would add on that topic is Ashley and a team are really working to find exactly that. What are a multi-tiered approach? Are there online opportunities that can, for a student who has a full schedule? I believe it's 60 hours of instruction, so it's not necessarily an easy lift either out of someone's curriculum. So I know they're kind of looking at not just you can take this class and be done, but here's a variety of options for you to pick at from as a learner that work with you before you graduate. So I know that we're not at a point with a full plan yet, but there's a team that's been working and we'll have something prepared for us.
Right.
So I just wanted to comment real quick on, I know that the business classes at Marysville High School do an excellent job on this, just from personal experience, learned about investing, mortgage rates, budgeting, microeconomics, macroeconomics, all within the business environment. So my child got a very good financial education through those business classes.
That's very helpful as a parent, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah, sometimes you don't want to listen to your parent, to the parents. So, okay. Roll call, please.
Ms. Savage?
Yes.
Mr. Catton?
Yes.
Mr. Ferguson?
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Ms. Devine?
Yes. Motion carries. Now, comments and questions from board members. We'll start with you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you. A couple things from the building report. There was, from the high school, there are really two things. One that, and it also applies to Bunsell, the students from Bunsell have gone through and toured both the high school and the early college high school in preparation for them to choose their educational pathway. And I know that the focus from the district has been for students and parents to recognize that we have lots of educational opportunities, and hopefully they will focus on the educational opportunity, the educational pathway, as opposed to which brick-and-mortar structure that they go to, so that they get the best education, appropriate education for their needs. The other thing that they reported was that the Ohio School Wellness Initiative pilot program has begun, and I'm really excited about the potential for that to help our district meet needs of our students and also serve as a model for other schools in the state of Ohio. I applaud Tri-Academy. They've had 13 completers so far this year. Yay! They're doing well. Bunsell, the thing that jumped out at me there was that they collected items for Western Kentucky, which our students have always responded to the needs of our community and to the needs of our nation. And this is one small example of where our students are recognizing what's going on in the world and doing something about it. They have the initiative to step up and to get some things done in a very positive way. Last thing up at Raymond, there are pride groups, and for the new board members, the pride groups in Raymond are comprised of students from kindergarten through fourth grade. And that group of students meets occasionally for 4 years, with new kindergartners coming in at the beginning of the year and the fourth graders then moving on. But that group stays the same, and they were given a challenge to come up with a way to keep Santa safe over the holidays. And they were given a Santa egg and had to devise some sort of protective covering for this egg in case Santa fell out of the sleigh. And then they had an assembly and dropped them from a ladder. And I don't have the results, but it looked like the kids were having great fun.
Thank you. Mr. Peck.
I really don't have much. I'd just like to thank Mr. Johnson for all the time he spent with me yesterday and educate me on all these things. So thank you very much.
Ms. Savitt.
I just wanted to reach out and say thank you to Early College High School for the opportunity to do the mock interviews. I thought that was a great opportunity to business people to interact with young people at the Early College High School and have a two-way communication on interview skills. So that was a wonderful experience. I also wanted to appreciate the past 3 years that I spent at Ohio Point as our representative there. And I look forward to working with Steve Cox as he transitions into that role. And we really appreciate him stepping up and becoming a part of the team. I did want to bring up something that appeared in the newspaper. It's in regards to the solar farm income. It was on the front page of the JT. It was actually a good story. The only thing is, if people skim the story kind of quickly, they might assume that Marysville School Systems is getting $688,000 in the immediate future. And that's estimated future income, but that is not income as of now. And I'm sure Todd and Diane will keep us posted when that is on the horizon. But just wanted to kind of clarify that point, because I got a couple phone calls about, you don't need to do a levy now, or something like that. So, but it was a very good story. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ferguson.
Yes, thank you. First, I just want to say thank you to my fellow board members and the administration for spending hours of time these last few weeks just help catching me up to speed. I really do appreciate everyone's willingness to meet and hear me out, for wherever I'm at in the spectrum on catching up here. Second, I had the opportunity to go to the Early College High School for their STEAM night. And it was a really good experience for me to see some of the projects that the students did, completed, and the interactions with the teachers there. And everyone seemed in good spirits, excited to be there. One parent came up to me. I was asking, there was this project, and I was asking the student presenter some questions, and he was communicating with me. And apparently, he was deaf, and I had no idea. And she said, that's because the school district has invested in the student, from kindergarten all the way up. And that was incredible for me to have that experience, and because I had no clue. And he did a very good job answering some questions. And lastly, I do want to just say thank you to all of our teachers and our staff. I understand, everyone is, it's a very fluid situation with COVID and the staffing shortages. And I understand everyone's giving it their all, and it's been a long road. But I know, and I'm an optimistic person, I'm a person of faith, I know that the light is at the end of the tunnel, and I just wanted just to reaffirm that hope, there's some messaging out there, I hope this will never end, but I believe it will end, and I believe we will get back to normal, and we won't face these interruptions as frequently as we have in the past. So I just keep up the good work, and thank you very much for everyone's hard work.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Nothing to add.
Mrs. Allen.
I would just like to recognize our Board of Education. January is Board Recognition Month, and so you should have each received a certificate on your little tabletop. But also just wanted to, not only has it been a difficult span, but it's been a difficult span for the board as well, just not the staff. And certainly have had heated discussions and not so, maybe not the nicest comments stated about our board members. And I think that our board has really taken the time to listen and hold your head up high, even when decisions have been difficult, and always put the kids first. So as a superintendent, I want to thank you for being a great team member, as our governor's team, and just appreciate all that you do to try to push forward for our kids. The last thing I would say, I would just ditto, I have a little note here. To the staff, we see you, we're all tired, and we just need to keep pushing through. This is a challenging time during this most recent peak, and I would say it's the most most difficult and challenging. Principals are spinning at both ends, taking phone calls till midnight, and then starting back up at 5 a.m. to make sure we're covered in classes. And people from my office are teaching first grade and second grade on some days and covering lunch duties, and it's all hands on deck. And you know, every person is doing something that they never dreamed they would do, from custodians to bus drivers to teachers to principals. So I do believe we're on the cusp of change, and just need to stick in there together. So couldn't appreciate more that everyone's pushing up the sleeves and doing everything they can to push through.
Thank you, and thank you for your kind words about the board. I also wanted to thank your parent advisory group. You know, I know that they've spent a lot of time, and they've been willing to share their thoughts and help inform the decision-making process and recommendations to the board, so we really appreciate them. I also want to point out that Mr. Keck and Mr. Ferguson have both signed up for the new board member training. It's a two-day training course, and so I just think it's important for our community to know that our board is continuing to be committed to ongoing professional development and learning. That's really an important part of our work plan. So kind of tied into that, some training and learning opportunities on January 25th or January 27th, both days. They have a Learn How Community Learning Centers, or CLCs, Transform Schools into Community Hubs. It's a free OSBA offering. And then February 24th from 6 to 8 p.m., there's a evaluations class, kind of talking about the importance of evaluations and maybe giving some tips on how you can do a better job with that. And then March 5th is Board Member 201, which is kind of a follow-up from that Board Member 101, just kind of some additional leadership and refreshers on a variety of different things. And I know we've in the past, you know, we've really enjoyed doing building visits. Just kind of want to say, let's hold off for a little bit as we get through this craziness and everybody is so stressed out. So, you know, maybe after spring break we'll do that. January 28th through 30th, Creekview is going to have their musical Frozen. So if you're available that weekend, I tell you what, every musical I've attended has just always blown me away. No matter what grades they are, our students and the staff that work with them and direct them just do an amazing job. There's lots of other extracurricular activities, so go Monarchs. And then our Hall of Fame, Marysville High School Hall of Fame, is this Saturday. So the board is welcome to attend that. They're actually going to be inducting the class from 2021, as that was canceled last year, and 2022, so six people will be inducted. and that the reception starts in the Commons at 5 p.m., and then the inductees will be introduced in between the JV and varsity basketball game that evening. Couple of other people that I wanted to call out right now that I would really love to formally recognize sometime before the end of the school year, and that's Amy Zwizinski and Officer Petzinger. I think there was information out there on both of them. Amy Zwizinski has covered our blessings in a backpack for the past 10 years, and she's just recently handed it off to a new person who's going to be handling that. And Amy and her family and all of her volunteers have done an incredible job. And then Officer Petzinger has been our resource officer at the high school. I can't remember how many years he's been there. It's been quite a while. So anyways, I just wanted to thank them publicly. And I think it's funny when you were talking about the building notes, Mr. Smith. I think every building, I had the same things that jumped out at me, you know. But it's just, I just think overall, it's great to see the focus on student achievement in every building, while also recognizing the importance of some of those other types of activities that just help our students become really well-rounded people who are committed to being great community members and serving and helping others. So with that, I would accept a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Motion by Mr. Smith.
Second
by Mr. Kett. Roll call.
Mr. Smith.
Yes.
Mr. Kett.
Yes.
Mr. Ferguson.
Yes.
Ms. Savage.
Yes.
Mr. Bynum.
Yes. Motion carries. We are adjourned at 7:45. Thank you.